I was a folk singer in Greenwich Village just after Dylan left. Richie Havens and Roger McGuinn, who was then Jim McGuinn, and Jose Feliciano, more guys than I can actually think of to name, were on the street in those days. And I was doing that for a couple of years, and then one day I heard from on high, "Get out of town." It really was a voice from on high. I have no idea. I'm not a very mystical guy, but this is what happened to me. And I said, okay. Just let me get a ride to and a place to stay in either LA or San Francisco, and I'm gone. And I was turned out to be LA. And I landed in LA in June, late end of June, 1965. And I think I was auditioning for the Monkees by August or so, because it was a long, drawn-out process, and we signed in October. So that's basically, I mean, Steve Stills, it was a friend of mine from Greenwich Village, who also was on the West Coast, who told me about it and said, "Go try out." And I went, yeah. And he called me back. He said, "No, go try out." I went, "Okay, if you say so." And the rest is a hysterectomy. I think that the Monkees, as a TV show, were the 60s on television. There were no other TV shows of its type, in fact, not since, particularly in this one respect. The Monkees had no adult, grown-up adult figures. We were young adults, college-age kids that, you know, on our own, with no authority over us, and that was unique. There was never, I mean, not until, I guess, the Young Ones or something like that, you know, was there ever another TV show like that, and that was like 25 years later. And in a sense, that was the one of the aspects of the 60s that the Monkees embodied as a TV show, again, not the necessarily the four of us as members of the group, but the TV show, the whole phenomenon. The 60s on television, as the Beatles had been the 60s in the music and in the making of that movie, and the music overall in general. Now, the Monkees' music was not terribly representative of the 60s. It certainly didn't break any new ground. It was just good bubblegum pop music. But I think the TV show was the way in which we did reflect the 60s. We were a little behind the curve, of course, but television's behind the curve anyway, so. Honestly enough, I don't think any of us changed particularly. I mean, we got more comfortable as performers and actors. We grew into our roles. We became more comfortable as members of a cast of a TV show. We felt more competent to have a say in what the TV show did. But in terms of the personality changes among us, I don't think any of us has changed very much since, honestly enough. More so, if anything. I mean, I'm way mellower than I was then, God knows. And a lot of the stuff I was doing back then, I still hold dear and believe in, and I'm still doing. Well, it was magnificent knowing Jimmy. He was one of the sweet guys on the face of the earth, and we talked music. He would even drop by the house and jam from time to time. Buddy Miles, who later drummed with Jimmy, was a friend of mine. And that kind of thing was really wonderful. I used to hang over at Mama Cass's house from time to time. I even dated her sister for a year. But you know what happens is after you meet somebody and get to know them just a little bit, the fame thing just drops away. You get to know them, they become people, and you get to see where Jimmy was basically just a purely sweet guy and where he was hidden and tucked away and what made him angry. It was a, I mean, now you're also talking about people who are very sharp. Mama Cass is one of the brightest, was, one, bless her heart, one of the brightest people I ever met. And it was a joy to be around. The wit was sparkling along, at, you know, just popping along at a wonderful rate. And that was the real joy of being at that level, is to be able to hang with those people as people. Let's see, who else? There were, you know, you meet, all, we met all of them. I met Mick Jagger. I did get to hang a little bit with George Harrison, played some sitar and guitar and some music. And I even worked for him on a musical project that he did called Wonderwall, where he did the music. I came in and played some banjo for that. And so we got to meet them and got to see what these guys are about. And it was a, it, it's always a joy to get to know these guys. But again, it's like You get past the fame and you get who they are as people, and that's the fun of it in many ways. It varied depending on where we were. Here in Los Angeles, it wasn't as bad. We had to be careful where we went. We could get not exactly mobbed, but because they're much too blasé in L.A., but it would be hard to go shopping because you'd be pestered for autographs every 5 minutes, every step of the way. When we were on tour and the kids were screaming, teenagers were waiting for us at every corner, we could not leave the hotel rooms. And in fact, that scene in the movie does actually describe fairly accurately one moment. I think it was Cleveland, only we didn't do it on purpose. We just turned around and the people who were with us and supposed to be shepherding us around were gone, and we didn't know. And we opened out a door and we were on the outside in the street, and these screaming kids are coming running at us, and we did jump into a cop car and we did make them deliver us around to the tradesman's entrance so we could get back into the hotel. Where were you guys? One of the things about mobs of kids, and one of the phenomenal things about it, when I am at a distance from a screaming, or was, you guys don't bother me like you used to. When I was at a distance, I was what they saw on TV, and that was worth screaming for and diving at. They get right up close to me like this, and suddenly I'm a human being, and they go, oh, which is fine if there's only two or three, because then they go, oh my God, I'm so excited, oh, how are you, and what are you doing? And then there's conversation, however stilted and scared, this conversation. But if there's 100 of them, the ones in front are going to go, oh, it's a human being. But the ones in back still think that it's the TV show, and they still need to crush forward to get a touch of it, and the kids in front get crushed, and that's when the danger occurs. Otherwise, it's all perfectly good spirits. Nobody is remotely interested in causing anybody any damage. But it got a little scary in Cleveland. Moving from Greenwich Village to the stages of monkey stardom, it's such a long ramp. We had to practice, we had to get ready, we had to do an hour-long set, and what were we going to do, and were we going to structure it, and we wound up rehearsing it so that the amazing thing was the volume, the scream volume, but the actual business of playing, I think we ramped up slowly enough that it wasn't a shock. It was, you go out there and I gotta put on my bass, start playing, 1, 2, 3, and go and play. And it was a lot of fun. Once in a while we'd hit the pocket and then I was transported, which is all I ever ask from life is transportation. But I can't say that I noticed how much different it was to play on stage than it ever was in the Greenwich Village days. I would have to say that when we made the third album, we did have all the freedom we wanted. We also knew that we had a responsibility to make the best pop album we knew how to make. We weren't into self-indulgence in the sense of, oh, I just feel like playing dreamy music now. I mean, none of that. We knew we had to turn out pop tunes. We did some Carole King tunes. Harry Nilsson came along about that time. We did a couple of his songs. We wrote one straight Chuck Berry-style rocker and threw that in there. And Mickey wrote a couple of songs. I wrote one. Mike had a couple. Davey eventually wrote, although not on the third album. But the idea was make a good album. So in a sense, we had freedom. And in another sense, we felt like we were under the gun. I mean, we had to, you know, we replaced Donnie Kirshner ourselves, as it were, and that was pretty tall boots to fill. Donnie actually selected the songs and the producers. That's about it. He said, they'll do great with this song. Give it to Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart to do. Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart wrote such and such a song. Carole King wrote such and such a song. Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil wrote such and such a song. Neil Diamond wrote them. Give Neil Diamond songs to Jeff Barry. Jeff Barry would take them into the studio, make the background tracks, fly them to the West Coast, and Mickey would sing on them. So the song selection, the arrangements. Now, it's a very different kettle of fish when it's the four of us in a studio, because the arrangements grew out of what we could and could not do as a band to play. We played sometimes 50 takes of a song while we worked on the arrangement, tried to make it, well, no, it should do this, it should turn here, and there should be a break, and you should take a thing there. And all that stuff is mapped out ahead of time in the pro ranks. The major producers that Donnie hired would go to an arranger, and he'd say, well, let's do this, and we'll have this. And the arranger would say, yeah. And then he'd write out all the parts and give them to the guitar players, and the guitar players would read off of the sheet music and go home. And that was the way they made records on Tin Pan Alley if you weren't in the group. And the way we made the record was the way you make the record if you're in the group, which is you're in the studio and you play and you say, let's not do that. And you actually carve out the arrangement as you work. I think, I listened to that album. It's a garage band album, but it's not that bad for me. You could disagree, Mr. and Mrs. America. I have to say that I think that the Daydream Believers, the movie, didn't delve very carefully into the actual mechanics of the breakup of the Monkees. For my money, Michael was very much interested in his own career for reasons of his own, which I'm not going to begin to guess at. But primarily, I think Michael saw the chance for the Monkees to take over their own music I don't understand exactly. It might have been Michael actually, as a sidelight, did produce two cuts on each of the first two albums himself, and they were tunes of his own, and they weren't bad. And he did it in the professional way. He went to an arranger and had parts written out and gave them to the side men and had the studio cats come in and play the song. Then when we did Headquarters, he was in there with his guitar, and even with a pedal steel guitar, which I wish he'd kept up with. I would love to have seen that. And he joined us for that album. Headquarters was, in fact, the only album that we actually did make ourselves until 97, when we made Justice, which was much later now. But at the time, after Headquarters, we went into what I call a mixed mode. That is, I was there playing either bass or guitar or keyboards, and sometimes Mike was. And we had another drummer, and we had arrangements, half-baked arrangements, and so it was sort of a half situation. I'm actually playing the piano on Daydream Believer, and that's actually me playing piano on Pleasant Valley Sunday. And Mike plays the lick on Pleasant Valley Sunday, the guitar lick. So we did go into a kind of a mixed mode. Davey was sick of banging the tambourine. He didn't. What was the question again? Mike's relationship. Actually, I don't know what more there is to say. We had a kind of a labor organizing kind of a thing where the three of us, not I, tried to form a kind of a union activity. And it was the guy that Mike selected who produced Headquarters too. That was Chip Douglas. Michael just got him and said, here's your new producer. And nobody said, well, wait a minute, I wanted Steve Stills. And nobody said, well, who do you want, Peter? And so next time I turn around and Chip is doing the producing. They went and did a labor action, and it was Michael who got the guy, the agent who stood in for the other three. Then I quit the Monkees in late 68, and they went on without me. The three of them went on without me for, I guess, another year or most of another year. I think Michael was pretty much in charge, although I don't know. You'd have to ask Davey and Mickey. I did not catch a paper airplane in my mouth. That's fanciful. In fact, my personality test, the black and white section where Mike and Davey were there, I was very wooden. In fact, I think it got me the part because I did a kind of a dummy guy, and I wound up playing the dummy as a result. I think partly as a result of that. I understand that Davey was already part of the package. Michael is the only one of us who actually read the ad and walked into the casting call. But I walked into casting call as Stephen told me to go try out for it, and Stephen Stills I mentioned earlier. I thought I had an in, and I walked into the cattle call, and I didn't. So I don't know. I auditioned from scratch, as did Mike. It's hard to know. What I've seen of those acts is that they're very talented, very hardworking, much more hardworking than it seems like we did. Or at least I should say the precision of their act is much higher level than certainly than the precision of ours. On the other hand, in our day, that kind of act would have been laughed off the stage. And nowadays, our kind of act would be laughed off the stage if we went up there fresh, I think. I mean, there are bands that still, garage bands, go get up there, and one, some of them make it every so often. But as far as the obvious thing goes, you just have to say it's obvious. They were auditioned and crafted into a pop phenomenon, and but they're certainly talented cats. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to audition 500 and take the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th best people who showed up. You're going to take the top. You're going to lop it off at the very top as far as you can. So you know that everybody in those acts is gifted, and I see it. You can, there's no doubt about it. Those guys are clearly gifted. And but as far as the rest of it goes, beyond the obvious, I don't think there's anything much to be said. Let's see. After I quit the Monkees, I hung around, hanging with, pretty much hung with this, pretty much the same old gang. Then my money ran out because I had unwisely parked it, as it turns out. I wound up with a bunch of friends in a rooming house, actually, for a little while. Then a romantic affair took me to through Marin County, north of San Francisco, where my ex-mate and our baby daughter were living. And I found a kind of a home there. And the next thing I did was to stay in the Marin County community. Worked in a rock group called Osceola and a 35-voice rock choir called the Fairfax Street Choir, and a few solo shows and like that. And I did that for a few years, and then I came back down here. Basically, ever since then, I've just been knocking around. More recently, I've gotten myself in the middle of a great, what I think is a great blues band called Shoe Suede Blues. We just played here in L.A. the other night. We'll be on the West Coast. We'll be on the East Coast in the spring. And we play the blues and blues rock and some rockabilly and some way ancient stuff. And basically, ever since the Monkees, it's mostly been about the music. Trying to get along playing my music. For people who are not familiar with the blues, you're not going to be familiar with the people that turned me on to the blues. But if you've ever heard of Muddy Waters or Lightnin' Hopkins or John Lee Hooker, these are the guys that Eric Clapton sees as the heroes of all time. Robert Johnson, of course, wrote the famous, some of the great songs that Cream did when Eric Clapton was doing Cream. Sort of the daddy of the blues, Robert Johnson, in many ways one of the great earliest recorded blues singers. Any number of blues performers who are just wonderful, and blues singers who did rock, the great R&B. There was a time when R&B and rock and roll were the same thing, and that was a time when music was glorious. Honestly enough, I wasn't paying as close attention to it then as I should have been, but I appreciate it now. Little Richard is the greatest rock singer of all time, and there'll never be as good a rock singer as Little Richard. Not ever again. Like, there will never be as good a guitar player as Jimi Hendrix ever again. He swamped the field, took it over, laid waste to it, and, you know, passed over. And you can't do any better than that. You can be as good in a different way, but you'll never be better than Jimi Hendrix. You just can't. So Jimmy was so deeply influenced by the blues, and you can hear that. Almost all of rock guitar playing is 99% of rock guitar playing is blues guitar playing. Sometimes it's tweaked and heightened and, you know, doped up with something or other, but it's all blues, essentially. The thing about the blues is that it's not about the blues. Let me repeat this. The blues is not about the blues. Not really. The blues is the topic, is the nominal subject matter. But the blues is about how we're all in this together. You sing the blues, and I know somebody else has been through what I've been through, and I'm not alone. That's what the blues is about. My advice for people who are interested in the arts is don't get a day job. I repeat, don't get a day job. Give everything you've got to your art. Give it all you've got. If you don't give it everything you've got, you'll never know whether you could have been good enough. And if you do, then you'll know. And if you take a day job and it gets in the way of your art, I mean, unless you want to be one of those people who goes through life saying, well, I could have been, I could have been, I could have been. I mean, if you really want to do your art, you'll do your art. Basically, nobody can tell you whether you want to do your art. You'll be doing it. The Beatles were playing, what, 11 hours a night in Hamburg, Germany, in their youth, and sleeping, you know, six to a mattress or something in flea-ridden hotels because they wanted to play. And similarly, all of the greats have been just did it. All they ever did was do it. And all I've ever the greats have been just did it. All they ever did was do it. And all I've ever wanted to do is to play, and I do it as much as I can, which is maybe not as much as I should, quote should, but if you want to be a musician or an artist of any kind, just do your art.